We are at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, just down the road from the Salk Institute and the new Sanford Consortium building. And Gino used to work at the Salk Institute,
right,
but is spending most of today with his group unpacking boxes.
That's right,
at
just
Sanford
today.
Consortium.
That's right.
Why?
Well, so today is the first day we begin our new life at the Sanford Consortium building. We've just moved from UCSD, having been in a smaller space, right, at UCSD for the past 3.5 years now. I think almost three and a half years. And we've just moved. It's the first day the first labs. So Carl Willard, my lab, and I guess sort of the stem cell core have moved to the new building.
Right, and we were there only a week ago.
That's right, for the opening.
And it was the sixth stem cell meeting on the Mesa, and you've spoken at previous stem cell meetings on the Mesa. So I think of you primarily, correct me if I'm wrong, as a stem cell scientist.
Yes, I actually think of myself as an RNA and genomics scientist that is answering questions using stem cell models. But
fine.
Yes, it's
for a general audience.
For a general audience,
right. What is an RNAi?
RNA. An RNA. So an RNA molecule.
So you're not doing the I in there as well?
No I in there.
RNA.
Just RNA.
RNA genomics model then.
Right.
What are you talking about?
So in every cell, you have your DNA, right? And you generate these RNA molecules that eventually become processed into
proteins,
right? And so these RNA molecules are thought of as a transient intermediate before you make the all-important proteins in the cell. But that's not true, because RNA molecules are actually really important. They actually have functions aside from their their role as becoming protein. They actually have other functions as well, right? And so they do. There are many steps in the processing of RNA that gives gives us diversity, gives us a functional changes that are different from just proteins alone. So that the RNA is important. Defects in RNA processing gives you diseases, changes homeostatic states in stem cells. RNA is good.
This is not an at issue with the original central dogma of Crick and Watson, and particularly Francis Crick.
Right.
RNA makes DNA makes RNA makes protein. So this middle chunk that is where you live.
Yes, it is where we spend a lot of our effort and time in trying to understand how RNA is processed to ensure that a cell or a neuron, or an organism stays in homeostatic balance. And when you have misregulated RNA processing, it gives rise to actually pretty severe genetic diseases like ALS or spinal muscular atrophy, right? And so there are a lot of diseases that are RNA in origin, and so that's sort of what we study.
So what do you mean by what's the role of the RNA in keeping the system in homeostasis then? How does that work?
So when we think of RNA in a cell, I think of it as a string of nucleotides that have proteins that bind to it. And these proteins that bind to it are important for keeping the RNA intact, but these proteins also give new opportunities for the RNA to be modulated, and you can modulate RNAs in many ways. So it's the simple model of making RNA and then RNA eventually becomes protein. I mean, it's actually really simplistic, because you can process RNA using these proteins that bind to RNA in numerous ways. Mm-hmm. And for example, you could take an RNA molecule and process it slightly differently, and you get two different proteins from it, from the same original RNA molecule. That's the process of alternative splicing, for example. And you can also take RNA and you can edit RNA. And so the nucleotide content of the RNA is now different. It encodes something a little bit different. You can process RNA and make it into smaller pieces of RNA that alone will have a function that is outside of it having to be made into protein. So it doesn't have to be made into protein. It can exist functionally as an RNA molecule by itself and have a function on its own.
Yeah, here's a PLOS paper that was 2007 with Rusty Gage. Alternative splicing events identified in human embryonic stem cells and neural progenitors. So unpack that for me, because the...
So the process of stem cell differentiation, right? So in this case, taking embryonic stem cells and making specifying the embryonic stem cells towards a neuronal lineage is important to understand early neuronal development that you can do sort of in vitro in a dish that enables you to sort of study different processes that you cannot study simply in looking at this in vivo. And so when you do this in a dish, this also gives us an opportunity to then try to understand the diversity of RNA molecules in stem cells and how they are different, how they change, how they're modulated at the level of RNA processing when the cells become neuroprogenitors, right? And one of these steps in the modulation of RNA molecules is alternative splicing, which is probably the biggest contributor to the diversity of proteins in human, right? Actually any given cell. So we know that if you look in the genome, there are probably 20 to 25,000 protein coding genes that exist, low size, right? That exist. Mm-hmm. But if you go measure the number of proteins that are present in cells, the number is much higher. Mm-hmm. So the numbers 100,000, for example, proteins. So how do you get from a smaller number of genes to a larger number of proteins? Yeah. Alternative splicing is sort of the biggest contributor, because you can take pieces of RNAs and you can remove them at will, and the other pieces can be put together to give you one protein. And if you include or exclude a smaller piece of RNA, it can encode a different protein. And this process of sort of regulated inclusion or exclusion of pieces of RNA is the process of alternative splicing. So you can go from stem cells to neuroprogenitors, and we were actually really surprised to find that there were actually, even this small step, there were many RNA molecules that were undergoing this alternative splicing process, which would imply that that there's this level of complexity that was before this not even well appreciated, going from a sort of simple step, right?
Right, but if we go back to the original thing that we were talking about there, the central dogma, our DNA makes RNA makes protein, and then move forward 60 years.
Okay.
Because Francis did that paper in 1958. No, it was the original paper was 53, but his major central dogma paper was 58. The shift from then to now, and you're talking about the complexity of all these gyrations that are going on.
Right.
Is the only way you know about this is through technology, isn't it?
That's right. So in the past, let's say, not that distant past, so let's say 10 plus years ago, people have sequenced pieces of RNA molecules in the cell, mm-hmm. right? And these are deposited in databases. These are called express sequence tags. They represent a mature RNA that's selected from a population of cells. And even then, even in this data set, at that time it was 1 or 2 million different expressed sequence tags. You you can align these tags to the genome and already identify that there were these alternative splicing events that were happening. So basically, different RNAs were aligned to the same genomic loci, and some RNAs, because they were mature, were missing pieces that other RNAs that aligned, that were coming from the same place, had, mm-hmm. right? And already then, people estimated that many genes, human genes, underwent this interesting process of alternative splicing, one of many RNA processing steps. Now, today, right, so today we can do this, you know, that took probably lots of different labs, a lot of money to collect all these different express sequence tags. Today, in one or two sequencing runs on the high-throughput sequencing instruments, we can generate we can generate billions, literally billions of tags. And we can use the tags to then actually enumerate all the possible RNA transcripts that exist in a cell. And this information really tells us that for every human gene that's encoded in the genome, there are at least two or more potential alternative isoforms, so different forms of this gene encoded by mature RNA that likely becomes two or more different proteins. So that explains it sort of going from a fixed number of genomic loci or genes to generate a lot more protein diversity than was previously thought, right?
But these various fields together represent an explosive time, don't they?
That's right.
Because I mean, you've got stem cell going on. You've got you did some work on embryonic stem cells, right. Of course. Shinya Yamanaka stuff, we have the
iPS cells,
induced pluripotent stem cells. Yeah. You've done transcriptional signature memory retention of human-induced. Right. You've got the RNA processing in the stem cell biology. Mm-hmm. You've got the disease modeling we've been talking about here. Yeah. As they all come together, what was your entree into this? I mean,
I see.
Go back to, I mean, is it being in Rusty's lab, or were you thinking about this before then?
Right. So the
let's go back. You know, chemical engineering and economics.
And economics, yeah.
Then you went back to Singapore.
That's right.
Where you were born.
Where I was born. I went back to serve in the military. I was in the Navy.
As a naval officer.
That's right.
And then you came back and do computational neuroscience at MIT with Tommy Poggio.
Chris Birch, yeah.
Right. So this is a very interesting did you have any idea that you were going to be meandering through all these things?
A lot of my experiences in life have been a series of good choices, but it was never planned. Planned too much. the interest in RNA really came about because of the availability, in some sense, of the genome. Looking back, I think I've always managed to take a change in steps, right? And change the path if something doesn't seem... something has sort of stopped becoming interesting, So when I joined Tommy Poggio's lab, it was actually to do computer vision, and that was really because I was inspired by books that Tommy and Terry Chernowski here at the SALC wrote, right, in vision and in learning theory, but it was clear to me very quickly, very early on in my graduate life, that that the models theoretical models that were built in computational neuroscience required experimental validation, and it wasn't always easy to validate these models. Quickly and easily, right?
Right, but so then you find yourself the Crick Jacobs Center.
Right.
You've got Rusty Gage as a mentor. Right. You've got Sean Eddy.
Right.
So you're working on neurogenesis. I think I have a paper on this.
Hippocampus-dependent
learning is associated with adult neurogenesis in mice. So you get it's an amazing grounding you're getting in these various different right. but intersecting.
They're
fields.
Intersecting, right? So my interests at MIT actually moved from the computer vision to the RNA work because the genome was then available,
right.
And so it turns out that all the computational tools that I was being trained in computational neuroscience and learning theory could easily be ported into genomics, mm-hmm. and basically looking at instead of neuronal sort of action potentials and spike trains, but looking at sequence data. Okay, so if I took all those, so I realized very quickly, very early on that I was interested actually in the neuroscience but in the cellular and molecular biology of neuroscience, but then my strengths were in the computational side, and in a good way of sort of leveraging my strengths in computational neuroscience and going into learning about cellular and molecular neuroscience was through what I thought was a good opportunity was through understanding molecular biology and understanding gene regulation. And I was lucky to actually have met Phil Sharp, who actually,
doing
obviously,
RNA biology and stem cells.
Right, exactly. Who
Nobel laureate.
Right, Nobel laureate, and discovered splicing, actually. So Phil Sharp and told me that, well, why don't I use the computational tools to actually look at computational problems in the RNA splicing field. And so actually that's how I sort of wandered into neuroscience, right? And so when I wandered into Chris's group, it was to work on RNA splicing, and then my second year there as a grad student, I helped Tommy Phil Sharp, and Chris Burge to write a collaborative grant on RNA splicing in the brain. That was funded, and so that was actually the start of my interest in looking at neuroscience, but at the RNA level, which actually seemed sort of obscure at the time, but today it's actually clear that that area is becoming more and more important.
But you would never have predicted this.
Yeah, no,
serendipitous.
Serendipitous. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Go back to the very first glimmerings, if you will, mm-hmm. of this career of yours. Usually I say to people, why did you get into science? Do you have parents who are interested in the science? Was there mm-hmm. a teacher? I know who your father is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Philip Yeo, of course, was running A-Star in Singapore and a private consultant to the Prime Minister of Singapore. So,
right.
And deeply interested in science.
In science, you're
so,
right.
So you kind of had that in the water. I mean, there's nothing...
That's right. he was always one to encourage learning, and he himself was trained as a systems engineer, mm-hmm. and so he's always been interested in tinkering, and that was very easily inherited. That curiosity for learning was always was really encouraged by him.
Plus the energy.
Yes, that's very it's the diffusion, right? It's yeah. there. So he's always encouraged freedom of whatever I wanted to do, right?
Right.
And initially I wasn't sure what I was going to do because he was an engineer that was somehow involved in economic development in Singapore, and so I was heavily influenced in thinking, well, you know, clearly engineering and economics must be important in life. And so I said, well, let's see if that's true. And so that's initially how I started in engineering and in economics. But then I got sort of bored with engineering and economics and realized for me the big questions were actually in biology, And then I realized that that was actually it wasn't something that he told me you go do biology. It was something that was interestingly in parallel where Singapore was then becoming more and more interested in biotechnology, and so he was then moved to help start A*STAR and push the in some sense the biotechnology sector in Singapore, and so growing that up.
Right. So make a comparison here for me between the United States and Singapore. In the sense that it's quite clear that partly due to your dad's dynamism, frankly, there was a major investment in science and technology.
That's right.
In Singapore. I mean, do you feel a little that we've lost some drive here, some impetus? I mean, let me characterize that further and say to you that when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. What do you think the rightful place of science is?
In the States?
Well, you can do Singapore as well.
The rightful place of science. So science has a very special arena. Because scientists like me, I don't consider science, doing science a job or a career. Mm. You know, it's something that that I would do essentially for free. And you know, don't tell my boss, right? But it's something that that you're driven by curiosity to do, right? And there are not that many careers like that in some sense. And I think that's important because the creativity that scientists have does spill over in almost all walk you know all, every aspect of life, right? And so in Singapore Singapore started off as a very strong manufacturing sort of based country. You know, it's always been developing products, right? Science is actually relatively new to Singapore, and it's sort of an industry that is a little bit different because the payoff is slow. Right, so Singapore is Singapore would do for example in the semiconductor industry you can sort of measure payoffs in 2-year increments, but in science after training the people developing the basic biology, identifying the drugs and mechanisms from that basic biology to actually treat disease and help human health, right, the payoff is much longer term. So science has an interesting role to play because without the sort of the creativity, the investment up front, right, and sort of the faith that with all that investment, people can create new things, new ideas that will eventually help human health. It's not just entertainment. It's not sort of moving money around. It is new products which will actually help someone live better and potentially cure diseases, right? That payoff is something that is a very different sort of time scale. So science has that place to play, and I think in some sense, what's similar. So I'm gonna just paraphrase your question a little bit and take some liberties with it, right? But what's similar with the States and Singapore in terms of science is that that Singapore is still young and in its infancy in learning how to do science, but we have had the advantage that a lot of resources have been put in a very systematic and organized way, and that a lot of people a lot of money have been invested in people to go off and do their get their PhDs in the States and then go back to Singapore, start labs and so on. However, I think right now in Singapore, it's important that that the existing government in Singapore. And this is the similarity, right? It's important that the government and the states also recognizes that the payoff of in science, investment in science is always far off. And I think that that's not always, that concept's not always something that's easy to for non-scientists,
bureaucrats, to understand. Payoff. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I think Singapore is still young, and I think Singapore has to, the governance of science has to mature to understand that some things take a long time to actually bear fruit. I'm afraid that the U.S. actually is starting to look more like that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If you were, I mean, so it's nice, you're opening the boxes, you're moving into the new lab and so on.
Right.
So you've reached a certain point in your career. You've been in these labs with wonderful mentors like Rusty Gage. You've had colleagues like Alison Watry and mm-hmm. so on, and seen all this stuff coming out of the lab. What were the key things you think that were the drivers for you? In other words, what would be your advice to a young scientist what should they be thinking, doing, wanting, being?
We're in an interesting time because we are in a recession, and so the advice I would normally give, and I think it's still the same, is to actually take, you know, for young scientists to actually take risks in exploring new things, and it's okay to fail. I think as scientists we often see more failures before something succeeds, right? And so the ability to sort of be okay with not, you know, getting the expected results, and then sort of trying something new, that ability to sort of get up when you're down is important. But because it's interesting because in this period where actually lots of companies are, I mean, this is true, lots of companies are actually losing people, laying people off, and in biotech and there, you know, and the grants are tighter today. It's harder to get federal money for research. I find that the younger scientists are more wary of future prospects, less likely to take risks because they do not want to in some sense fail, because they're worried that if they do, then, you know, they never get this a great track record, and they can't, you know, get into a strong lab and so on. So there's this sense of the sense is a little bit, I find that there's less optimism with the younger scientists today than if you than maybe 10 years ago. So if there's anything thing that I could, you know, I guess suggest to the younger scientists is to really still take risks and be more positive, right? Have more faith in themselves, I believe. Yeah, so
okay, here's another question that I tend to ask people. I mean, Singapore is in a sense a young country. So although it's a scientific dynamo, do you have some sense of the history of science as well? If I gave you a time travel token,
okay,
and said that you could bring to your dinner table anybody from any period of history and just sit them down and ask them questions, is there anybody you think, I'd really like to spend some time with him or her?
So I do, okay, so this has to be someone that's alive, someone that is...
No, Anytime.
That's an interesting question. My heroes in science have are actually still, I guess, I'm fortunate to have that my heroes are still alive. Oh. So
you can still have dinner with them.
So you know Sidney Brenner well.
Of course.
Right? And he's still, even before I've met him, right, in, I don't remember when, like in early 90s, right? He was always one of my heroes in science. And he's not someone, you know, in the past is still alive, right?
Mm-hmm. Very much
so, right? And so I think I'm still fortunate to be able to meet him often to hear his opinions about science and hear his experience about science. Mm. So that's probably more current, more modern than, I mean, someone that's still alive an answer than you expected.
But. Well, actually, the difficulty actually getting Sidney to sit down for any long period.
Right.
You'd almost need this time travel token to actually ensure that he came to the dinner table. So,
right. In some sense, having conversations with him, it's almost like time travel, because I mean, essentially, usually it's like time travel because he provides a perspective. That we don't usually pay attention to, right? So the history of science is not something that we usually pay attention to. I mean, that's absolutely true. But whenever Sidney sits down and talks about, sometimes you hear him bring up stories, and those are always, you know, those are always exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think are the most immediate steps that are going to be happening next in this particular part of the field that you're working in?
Okay, so there are three components, right? Three major areas I think in the field that I'm working on. There are very systematic and global questions with regards to how RNA. Right, is being processed, and there are sort of genomic and computational efforts that are taking place in my lab and also in other labs now to understand the interactions of these proteins that bind to these RNAs and regulate the processing of these RNAs, mm-hmm. to understand how they combinatorially do what they do. So every piece of RNA probably has dozens, if not hundreds, of proteins that bind to it that regulate different steps of processing. And so this sort of systematic map of how these proteins do what they do is kind of important because we don't know much about this area. So that's sort of with regards to the systems and computational biology and RNA processing. Then there's the second aspect of how does this relate to disease, right? And so in stem cells and in neurodegeneration today, so I have had the great fortune of working very closely with my chair, Don Cleveland, probably know Don, and actually in this new building on my floor, there are really strong people in the area of neurodegeneration, like Aldous Spada,
Larry Goldstein, exactly, and Larry's
actually my neighbor, right? So this area of neurodegeneration has become one of immediate interest with regards to RNA processing, because in 2006, there were papers that were published that indicated that defects in mutations in now two RNA binding proteins that bind to RNA can actually cause ALS. Mm-hmm. And actually, about a month now ago, there were two papers that were published that indicated that 40 or more percent of sporadic ALS patients have an expanded RNA repeat that is inside a gene on chromosome 9. Which is very similar to these expanded RNA repeats that are found in Fragile X tremor associated syndrome, which causes a loss of RNA function per se. So So this area in neurodegeneration suddenly is exploding with mutations being found in RNA binding proteins, where there is now loss of function in RNA. And so this is now quite interesting to my group, obviously, since we're experts in RNA processing. But then how do you understand all of this in large quantities of cells, so sufficient quantities of cells that you can actually do biochemistry to treat, you know, try different molecules, right? So that's where stem cells, or rather the iPS cells made from patients with mutations in RNA binding proteins are becoming useful tools in which we can use to really get at the underlying biology and also use the cells as potential ways to screen for molecules. We've just been actually awarded one of these innovation grants with Roche to try to find small molecules that can reverse some of this misregulated RNA processing in neurons from ALS patients. So that's the second area that's, I think, an important area in my field of neurobiology. The third sort of area that is quite interesting is trying to develop. There's a lack of tools that we can actually use to understand how, at the single molecule level, how RNAs interact, and how the misregulation of RNAs in neurons or in stem cells actually cause a disease. And so there is a great opportunity for engineering again. And for material sciences and for nanotechnology to come in and bring in tools that are already established in those areas, but apply them to the areas of stem cell neuroscience and RNA processing. So these are the three themes that
of your lab.
Yeah, my lab, right.
So yeah. Last question. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about?
Mm-hmm.
With regards to what, science, or with regards to...
Take it as you will.
Okay. Just because it is today where my lab is, I'm packing boxes in the new building. I'm actually really optimistic about being there. This is a really exciting time for my group. First of all, because we are in some sense expanding our horizons because we're also, you know, having new people join the group, but at the same time we've been in a place where we have new colleagues, and precisely the colleagues that will provide strength, complementary strength to us in these areas, in the areas of neurodegeneration and in neuroscience. So in some sense, I'm excited about the opportunities that will be present now.
New beginning.
There's a new beginning, and so that's and this is the, you know, this building will have actually, it's quite interesting because this building is I think the first building where you would have, you know, engineering people, right? You have the neuroscience, you know, cancer, and everyone's in some sense focused on regeneration and stem cells. So it's an interesting. It may be I haven't been here long enough, but it may be one of the first thematic buildings at UCSD, and I think so I'm optimistic about that. Right, we'll see how that goes. I'm hoping with these different disciplines there will be a lot of new multidisciplinary collaborations and synergy that will actually help us speed up on answering some of the questions we care about.
Well, I hope so too. We'll come back for a report and see whether the optimism was justified. Hope so.
Also,
Junior, great. Thanks for talking to you.
Thank you.